Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined once again by Hale. A couple episodes ago, we were talking about the Didache,
which is an early Christian kind of heretical, semi-heretical text that outlined kind of rules and expectations for very, very early Christian groups.
And you've got some other kinds of early Christian, like a particular work or an idea that you've been exploring.
Yeah, more some. I've been quite interested as of late in kind of the formation of early Christianity, as well as the transition ethically, morally, philosophically into what that kind of meant as a unified system that became ubiquitous across the West and around the world in many ways as well. So kind of an interesting thing to look at, especially with the origin story.
Yeah, definitely. Those sort of early moments in that are really, really formative and are going to set the stage for an extremely important pillar of Western European thought. But before we do that, I have my own sort of contribution to make before we get to what you have to say on early Christianity. And I have that in the form of a quote and in the form of a quandary. We usually do this bit at the beginning of our shows, but I think I'll make it my contribution for the show. So I guess appropriately, considering we'll be talking a little bit about Christianity, though I'm not going to be necessarily talking about his philosophy of Christianity or anything. My first quote is a passage that I spotted just kind of nosing through Søren Kierkegaard's concluding unscientific postscript. Now, I know that that's actually we did a small section of that for a show a while ago, but it's been a while since I've gone through concluding unscientific postscript. So this is kind of taken out of context, but I think it's relatively self-contained. It's a convenient passage to sort of bring to a quote section for a show, because I think that there is something interesting here to discuss the relation between the thinker and their thoughts. So the passage is in the section, The Subjective Thinker 2, so there's more than one part, but this is the passage. What is abstract thought? It is thought without a thinker. Abstract thought ignores everything except the thought, and only the thought is, and is in its own medium. Existence is not devoid of thought, but in existence, thought is in a foreign medium. What can it then mean to ask in the language of abstraction about reality in the sense of existence, seeing that abstract thought abstracts precisely from existence? What is concrete thought? It is thought in a relation to a thinker and to a definite particular something which is thought, existence giving to the existing thinker thought, time, and place. So in this quote, we're seeing Kierkegaard establish a kind of dichotomy, or like two different kinds of thought, right? Concrete thought gets a little less treatment, but I think that's because there's something curious about the notion of abstract thought that has to be explained, and that's what Kierkegaard is sort of diagnosing here, right, is this notion of a thought without a thinker, right? Now, how do you get a thought without a thinker? That seems to be impossible, right? I mean, thoughts are sort of dialectically in relation to, their existence is in relation to a thinker. You don't have a thinker without a thought, and you don't have a thought without a thinker, etc. So how do you get thought without a thinker? Well, Kierkegaard is saying that, interestingly, there is something kind of ontologically important about the thinker, and that is that they exist, right? So when you have a thought that abstracts precisely from existence, you get a thought that has a curious property, that is, a thought without a thinker, right? So in this as well, Kierkegaard is also asking, well, there's something also curious about abstract thought that tries to think about existence, right? Because it's precisely existence that the thought abstracts from, right? So any kind of abstract thinking about existence really doesn't bear a relationship to existence, because it's abstracted precisely from its sort of ontogenetic point, right? This point of origin, it's thinker, to which he contrasts with the concrete thought, which is a thought with a relation to a thinker. So it's not an abstraction from existence. It's a thought that actually sort of, in a way, bears the stamp of authenticity of the thinker who thinks it, right? This thought arises in this particular, he says, particular thinker, thought, time, and place, right? The thought doesn't make sense except in relation to a particular existent thinker, and that is always a situated or a rooted thinker in a particular context.
You can't have sort of free floating thoughts, especially about something as, you know, wide ranging or as ontological as just like mere existence. And so there's always got to be some kind of situated position that one takes, even on the most basic of ideas.
Yeah, even like the most conceptually fundamental, they do have some, again, I'm using this term, like an ontogenesis, right? They arise in time. Like no matter how abstract a thought is, or how, like we would say, like grand or whatever, no matter how philosophical it is, that arises in relation to a thinker. Now, the point, too, is that a thinker can abstract from existence, right? This is what, in another work that we've read together, I think it's Truth and Lying in, I forget the full title of it. Yeah, Truth and Lying in the Extramoral Sense by Nietzsche. He makes this point about concepts, right? Which is that a concept precisely is all of the things that that thing is a concept of with their difference dropped, right? So for Kierkegaard, what abstract thought abstracts from existence, what it abstracts from is existence. For Nietzsche, a concept abstracts from difference, right? So they're both kind of gesturing towards something like a prototypical philosophical thought that in some way is useful. Both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche would say they have their place, obviously, but there's an error that can happen when they try to do what they can't do, and that is precisely the condition for their existence, right? For Kierkegaard, an abstract thought abstracts from existence, and then it tries to think existence. Well, that's kind of absurd. And then Nietzsche wants to say, okay, well, you want a concept of something like difference or sameness, right? Which is Plato's great preoccupation with the koine of the ideas. How do, like, the sameness and difference of ideas themselves is an idea, and that just is the relation of ideas. And he's saying, at this point, we have, you know, we are in purely conceptual grounds, and we have forgotten that a concept just is those things with their differences dropped. Not necessarily that difference is a thing that we're trying to, like, figure out, right? Mm-hmm. So I just like this passage, too, because, again, it's nice when you can find these little succinct passages that they don't, like, reduce or explain anything, but they are these very well self-contained ideas that give you a way into thinking about someone like Kierkegaard, who has a lot to say, especially in concluding Unscientific Postscript. Again, we've gone into, I think we read Truth is Subjectivity a while back. So it's always kind of nice when you can find something kind of self-contained and get something out of that. It loans itself to a good reading.
And Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, they're the professionals of, you know, kind of pulling out those interesting little thoughts within a wider piece.
Mm-hmm, yeah, absolutely. They're like, the existentialists in general are quite good at, like, these sort of vignette ideas, you know?
Yeah, it's a good way. A vignette is a good way of putting it.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of like a miniature or a vignette. I mean, obviously, it doesn't capture, like, the whole work or anything. I'm not saying that it's a key to the concluding Unscientific Postscript, but it's a passage that is worth visiting, and you're not necessarily missing out if you just were to read that, right? It's quite self-contained. But
now, did you have a quandary as well?
Yeah, I did. So that was my quote. The other component of this is a quandary, where we kind of raise some question or problem or issue that we've been thinking over. Whenever I try to think about quandaries, I'm always like, it's difficult to think of like a particular quandary because a lot of them are quite, you know, like a personal, and that means like long ranging and maybe I've had them for a while. But one that I've found kind of a way into making a quandary is my, not like, I don't want to say like problematic, but it's always been a theme or like a question to myself is my relationship to my taste in like art, maybe, and like, I think specifically in music, because that's the main kind of like art that I engage with. But my tastes in music and art in general are not like, see, this is one of the other problems, and I guess part of the quandary is it's been difficult to try and describe it other than in terms that seem like, you know, highfalutin or pretentious or hipsterish. I get accused of being a hipster a lot because I will listen to things that like people haven't heard of or whatever, or I will just kind of be aloof to what people are listening to. So my quandary,
I mean, in terms of like popular music or whatever.
Yeah, in terms of like popular music, you know, people will like, for example, people will talk about like Bad Bunny or something like that lately, and I think that's because Bad Bunny was had something to do with the NFL at the halftime show or something. There was some kind of controversy around that. I have not I do not know anything about Bad Bunny. I don't know what their music sounds like, but I just know that that is like a thing. But the only reason I don't know about it is because, not because I don't know about music, it's just I'm preoccupied with like my own thing, right? I have my own interests that occupy my attention and leave me aloof to what is really going on and what people are really talking about. And for that reason, I'm difficult to talk music with, and therefore, you know, accusations of like putting on appearances or that meaning something other than just being a symptom of doing my own thing come up, right? So that's
yeah, I think sometimes people can see it as like verbose or whatever. But I also think like I barely know who Bad Bunny is as well, unsurprisingly. That there's sometimes this expectation that like you need to conform an interest to like popular art to be, you know, for it to be like recognized or for you. It also said it comes back around too, because it becomes a judgment process of like the enjoyer of whatever that esoteric art form is. You know what I mean? And you get exposed to judgment and all this kind of stuff. Then there's the other side where it's like aesthetic appreciation. Is it really just like a relationship between you and the artwork, or is it more of a social, historical, you know, sort of wave or movement that you get to be a part of?
Yeah, and that's one way of thinking about it in terms of like our different art movements or something like that. And that is one way that I think about the music that I listen to, because I understand that it's situated like in a particular time and it has a lifespan. Right? Like the music I listen to isn't going to be, it is like the music will, you know, it's saved on my computer and stuff like that. So it'll be there for a while. But the moment in which it's capable of being made with the sort of verve that I enjoy isn't going to be there forever. And I suspect that it's going to come, you know, very quickly. So I'm just trying to enjoy it while I can. But I bring up this all as a quandary in a certain, you know, quandaries are usually expressed as questions, but this is more like a personal problem for me. And in that regard, it is a kind of quandary in that there is a sort of problem of the way that that's perceived.
The problem is the perception of others.
Well, it's that too, in regards of like how other people, you know, the meaning of what that looks like for others. It's like, you know, okay, well, I'll explain it further by going into the person that I'm going to bring up to talk about this, which is kind of a familiar theorist that you and I both are kind of favor, which is George Hahn Mueller's ideas around prolificity, right? This idea that when we are engaged with a piece of you know, media or content or anything like that, there is always kind of the awareness that you will always be seen doing that, right? Or sharing it or expressing it always comes with this idea that that in itself is an appearance, right? It's not just that when you engage with a particular piece of art that looks like something, even like expressing that means that you're expressing the way that appears to what he calls the general peer, right? So it's not just like individual particular people who have thoughts or opinions or whatever, but always in the back of our mind, we've got this idea of being judged a particular way or being sorted into this particular category. And we're always cultivating what he calls profiles in light of that general peer, right? Now, the general peer can change depending on like a particular community or whatever. So if you're in a particular like subculture, the general peer for what that looks like to conform to their standards changes. But overall, social media, and I'm saying the problem here is like within, you know, the general public, you go and you talk to anyone and they will, you know, bring up particular bands or whatever that just play on the radio, and they will say, how do you not know about the Scorpions or whatever, you know? I just don't. But there is like the general peer has an expectation that you should know this band, and you know, that understand that knowing like niche artists on like SoundCloud or whatever is it's confusing.
It reminds me a lot of the ideas of a lot of existentialist thinkers, of the kind of like the they or Das Man or whatever, where there's this sort of expectation that you should be and are a part of like this sort of general cultural milieu, and that it's sort of expected that you would have a familiarity with, you know, Bad Bunny or whoever is popular or whatever that might be.
Yeah, there is that expectation. The interesting difference, I think, between the existentialists and and Mueller's idea of profilicity is that, well, the existentialists see this as a kind of like social phenomena or like a, you know, I guess like a, to be redundant, an existential phenomena, one in which your world is pervaded by dust mining, sort of constituted by that. And Mueller is influenced by those ideas. You know, the idea of like a general peer has a close resemblance to the they as constitutive of like a particular place. But what I find interesting about Mueller is that for him, it's more socio-technological, if that makes sense, because he seems to be quite mindful of the way that social media is constructed so as to enable these sorts of patterns. It's not just that it's like an existential structure that, you know, is our human condition, but we actually build these structures in, right? Like we could build other kinds of social media platforms that try to do something else, but for Mueller, this is sort of baked into our systems, right?
Yeah, it's a part of the current sort of technological social media system that we are all a part of. And, you know, and then obviously there's the whole thing about as a participant in that, you're creating your own profile, and your profile has to fit and be functional within like the wider scope of profilicity and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, one's interests in arts and entertainment are great. On the one hand, I think they're great aspects of participation in that profilicity, but they're also signals of correctness or virtue or whatever you want to call them as being a participant in that community.
I wanted to bring this up though, because it's not that I see like a clash between my own experience and what Mueller is talking about, because it's precisely what Mueller is talking about that I think sort of like grates me the wrong way. So Mueller's theory would have it that what we do is we are trying to cultivate profiles, right? So if someone is engaging in something niche, that what they're trying to do is cultivate some kind of profile of, someone who is like a crate digger or something. You know, they know the deep cuts. They're really tapped in on what's new or something like that. They're the cool hunter or whatever. But the interesting thing is like, is not necessarily that I'm even trying to do that. So it's I'm not like rejecting what Mueller is saying, but what I am saying is that it's precisely that there's like this theory that accounts for what I'm trying to do that almost feels like it just corroborates the exact like criticisms that I have of people who say things like, well, you know, you're just kind of like doing this for attention, or this is just pretentious or something like that. And it ignores precisely the actual art itself. Now, I don't think that, I think when Mueller says that, there has to be something about the art that is able to like speak to your profile in that way. Like the art has to be difficult to engage with or inaccessible or niche or unpopular or something like that in order to really fulfill that role. But more or less what I'm saying is like, if something was just niche, you could just theoretically go out and, you know, that's kind of like the caricature of the hipster, right? They just find something that they've never heard of, buy it, and then once they've got that, it sort of fulfills their profile role, right? They're the cool hunter. Whereas for me, my experience is that actually I'm like really just into one thing, and it's not so much about the cultivating the profile, but it really is about the work itself. And to try and sort of illuminate what that means, I wanted to put Mueller in, I wanted to set Mueller's theory next to a quote that I think I've brought up before on the show. I probably brought it up multiple times, but I'm thinking specifically of the quote by Brian Eno from his collection of essays, A Year with Swollen Appendices. And it is, I'll read the quote and then I'll tell you why I'm bringing it up. So he says, Brian Eno, he says, whatever you now find weird, ugly, uncomfortable, and nasty about a new medium will surely become its signature. CD distortion, the jitteriness of digital video, the crap sound of 8-bit, all of these will be cherished and emulated as soon as they can be avoided. It's the sound of failure. So much modern art is the sound of things going out of control, of a medium pushing to its limits and breaking apart. The distorted guitar sound is the sound of something too loud for the medium supposed to carry it. The blues singer with the cracked voice is the sound of an emotional cry too powerful for the throat that releases it. The excitement of grainy film, of bleached out white and black and white, is the excitement of witnessing events too momentous for the medium assigned to record them. So what I'm bringing this up, I'm bringing up this Brian Eno quote because it's Brian Eno is trying to say that there actually is something about the mediums themselves that contain their own limits, right? And there's something appealing about when we, as artists, really push those limits, right? That, you know, the guitar, when it's pushed to just being distorted so that it sounds nothing like what a guitar sounds like acoustically. Or, you know, the blues singer whose throat is expressing a sound more powerful than the throat can express. In my case, it's things like electronic noise music and whatnot, and pushing electronics to go be louder than they could possibly be, right? What Brian Eno here is saying is that there's something about the mediums themselves that express what is their appeal, whereas I'm saying, or the tension that I'm kind of trying to bring to light here is that for Mueller, the appeal of constructing a profile is around, you know, objective mediums doing their thing. But what Brian Eno is saying is that, well, mediums themselves have their own appeals independent of how they appear to a general peer, right? Because our attention, while we do always kind of have our minds, you know, on what the meaning of what we're doing is socially, our attention is sometimes, as artists, also on the mediums themselves and what the possibility of those mediums are, right? So there really are kind of moments of social lucidity where you're not considering at least consciously, you're not considering what this medium is going to look like on your profile. You really are just like taking a medium and pushing it to its limits. And in that moment, there's almost this possibility of like a social violation, because you're not doing things in consideration of what, you know, the general peer or what your profile looks like. You really are just making yourself look like a crazy person who doesn't know what's going on. You know, you really are just putting your head in the sand and caring about this like one really niche thing, right? I hope I'm like bringing the tension out.
Well, so far that's all been wonderful, but moving on, I think at this point it's a halfway point for the show. That we should kind of move on maybe to our second topic that we've been talking about. I actually had a quote as well that kind of intro us into our topic a little bit related, a little bit not. It's always what I'm like, my quotes and my quandaries. I have a quote here from the German poet Goethe. Is it pronounced Goethe or Goethe? Brandon's always the pronunciation expert.
I pronounce it Goethe.
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 Okay. We can blame my dyslexia for my terrible pronunciation, but Goethe. So the German poet Goethe had this to say. He said, he who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living from hand to mouth. And what I thought that was interesting about that quote is it really, obviously the idea behind it is that, like, you know, you... A complex life, you know, the kind of life that is, you know, worth living or is a fully human life is a historical life. And, you know, we participate in that historical life by drawing upon understanding, reinventing, reusing old ideas, forms, arts, you know, whatever it might be of historical artifacts. You know, and I really like how it highlights the 3,000 year mark there, because that's kind of like that. I was thinking about this earlier today. It's just a totally random thought as I was driving. That, you know, I've long, as I'm sure listeners know, I've long interest in kind of history generally, and we sort of draw this delineating line as well around like the 3,000. Some people do around the 4,000 year mark, but 3,000 especially. As the kind of like historical ancient era, like that's like the line where society, our culture, you know, things sort of start, right? And you go back, that's the, like the kind of the end of the Sumerian Babylonian period, running into, you know, the, you know, obviously the Persian and, you know, kind of Greco, you know, Renaissance, if you want to call it that. And then obviously rolling into the Roman Empire and such, like all that kind of stuff. Wait. So I just really thought, one, it's interesting. And I agree generally with the observation that like history helps inform our own lives, right? Like we've talked about this many times. I don't live my life in isolation. I constantly live my life in a fabric or a web of connections, which are all, in some sense, historical. And then on the flip side of that, it's even like even within Goethe's quote, you see how we're all particularly interpreting that, and collectively we have tendencies to interpret it in a certain way. So for example, his 3,000 year mark, it's like, well, human history obviously goes back far past 3,000 years, like the earliest, like large, you know, kind of structural settlements that we have are, you know, 10,000 years older or older. So it's interesting also, like, even Goethe has his own historical interpretation and sort of prism that he's looking through that informs him. And you even see it in the limitations that he puts on, or the delineations that he puts on within his own quote about historical understanding.
Yeah, that's an interesting... it's thinking about history as well, like, that is kind of a, you know... not necessarily being a historian, but being a philosopher kind of interested in history.